Hey, everybody. Welcome to another thrilling episode of Adventures in DevOps. I'm your host today, Will Button. And joining me today is Adarsh Shah. Adarsh, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So do you want to give us a quick introduction and tell us what we're going to talk about today?
Sure. My name is Adarsh Shah. As you mentioned, I'm the founder and CEO at CompuZest. I've basically played a lot of different roles over the years, from a developer to an architect to a consultant to technical product owner, mentor, advisor. But I'm an engineer at heart who loves to build stuff that helps business, technology stuff that helps run business. And right now, I have built a product as part of a company that I founded, and also do some consulting and advising around the DevOps and infrastructure as code space.
Right on.
Did you work your tail off to get that senior developer gig just to realize that senior dev doesn't actually mean dream job? I've been there too. My first senior developer job was at a place where all of our triumphs were the bosses and all the failures were ours. The second one was a great place to continue to learn and grow, only for it to go under due to poor management. And now I get job offers from great places to work all the time. Not only that, but the last job interview I actually sat in was a discussion about how much my podcast had helped the people interviewing me. If you're looking for a way to get into your dream job, then join our Dev Heroes Accelerator. Not only will we help you get the kind of exposure that makes you attractive to your dream employer, but you'll be able to ask them for top dollar as well. Check it out at devheroesaccelerator.com.
So one of the things, and I want to jump in this because I'm really excited about this. One of the things that you put in one of the articles I read from you was talking about not infrastructure as code, but environment as code. You want to bring everybody up to speed on that?
Yeah, definitely. So what I and some of the colleagues that I've worked with realized over the years is like, an infrastructure as code is great, right? Because it helps us automate provisioning of various infrastructure resources on cloud providers, on-premises. But what we realized is what people need is an entire environment, right? Just having your networking or just having your EC2 instances or what have you is not going to give you everything you need to run your application.
Right.
So what I and my teams have done in the past is like kind of go through this painful process of like write pipelines that run stuff, connect various pieces of these, if you think about it as Lego pieces, like bring them together, and kind of those things get really complicated and very difficult to manage. So what I kind of thinking about this more and more in last few years, I was like, you know what? I mean, there has to be a better way of bringing these pieces together. So started thinking of this as a concept and eventually named it as environment as code. It's just an abstraction over infrastructure as code that basically provides a way of defining an entire infrastructure environment, right? Not just a single component or a resource, but also it manages state for the entire environment, including the dependencies between various resources, and also supports best practices, right? Like when you look at infrastructure as code, one way of getting this whole environment is by writing this monolith infrastructure as code where you can put everything together, right?
Right.
But that's not a good practice, right? Like thinking about loose coupling and things like that. So yeah, that's kind of what I call it environment as code. But basically, it allows teams to deliver entire environment instead of individual infrastructure resources rapidly and reliably at scale.
Yeah, whenever I just first read the term, it was like this huge light bulb went off because I think the term itself is so much more descriptive of what we're trying to accomplish many times with infrastructure as code, because the infrastructure itself is just a component of the overall environment, right? And each individual piece of the infrastructure is pretty meaningless unless it's coupled with all the different pieces of that environment. And like you mentioned, I've built many environments using that monolith approach. And then you have to update one dependency in there or change out one of the components. And it follows very much along the lines of building a monolith software application, you know, where just making small changes becomes this task that you dread and procrastinate and hope that you don't have to do it, knowing full well that you're going to have to anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the other things, right? So some of the principles that we talk about is like immutability, right? So you want to be able to easily provision a brand new set of, like, let's say if we talk about servers, rather than updating and keeping a long-lasting server, in case of this, applying that same principle to the entire environment, right? So why keep your various components living for long? Can you actually replicate that entire environment rather than just an individual component?
Right on. So for someone listening who's liking this idea and wants to explore it further, what do you think the first steps to migrating from infrastructure as code to environments as code is like?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, I think it's just an abstraction for, so thinking about these various pieces and how they get together. So what we did is we essentially, to keep it really simple, is created a simple YAML format. Again, this is new. So I'm like, a lot of that I'm saying, at least from my perspective, what I've seen, I haven't seen anyone talk about it this way, but it's new. So what we did is we provide a very simple format, a YAML format that actually specify these individual resources or components and how they connect with dependencies. I have an article that I think I shared that talks about the principles and how, what this means. Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, early stage. So I would say like something that allows you to create an abstraction on top of infrastructure as code that gives you an entire environment rather than individual component, right? Because a lot of people, like I said, write pipelines, right, to do this. And then you have to think about things like, hey, how do I provision stuff? But how do I tear down, right? Because tear down would be totally opposite graph, right? So you have to tear down those leaf nodes first, and you just write all this complex logic if you change. So defining an entire environment, an easy format that provides ways to connect those Lego pieces, if we talk about it. And then that takes and interprets like into and provisions those individual pieces so that you get an entire environment.
Right on. One of the things you put in that article, you mentioned in there about keeping everything in source code, but then you added to that a little thing that I know I've slipped up a lot in the past doing this, and I've encountered situations where other people have done the same, like those one-off scripts that you only run ever once in a while, about how important it is to get those into source control as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you're talking about the patterns and practices in general for infrastructure, code, environment, because it doesn't matter. So yeah, like I think, yeah, same here, right? I've been in a situation where like, hey, we just ran the script and, you know, forget about it, right? Like it's on someone's machine. And then you try to find who did that and how it was done. So yeah, I mean, source control being a place where you can track things, have auditing, right? Who pushed, so you can talk to the person about it. And so yeah, like I think people say like, hey, just put your Terraform code or Pulumi code or configuration, no, everything, including bash scripts that are lying, so like, you know, that you use once in a while, everything needs to go there.
Yeah. What about documentation? Do you like documentation in the code itself, or do you have a preferred tool like Confluence or something else for keeping track of docs?
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things with docs is like, a lot of people say this, like, hey, you do infrastructure as code, or like everything is in code. Why do you need documentation, right? And it's just, I mean, yes, you need less documentation, but you still need documentation, right? In general, documentation is hard, I understand. but so like a lot of people are like, and I used to at one point, I was like, hey, we don't need documentation because, you know, everything is codified, but you still need, right? And talking about documentation, right? Quality documentation, making it available where, let's say there is an error, provide a link that can take the person who's actually looking at it directly to that. And also, it's just providing a way to keep it updated, right? So like I can draw a diagram or like write documentation and just, you know, like, hey, it's out of date. It's not going to be useful because it's actually giving you wrong information. So yeah, like I prefer obviously have naming things better in your code, right? Because that tells you what it is, but definitely have some documentation that's external to the code that'll get you started. Even it could be like, hey, here's an index of things that you look at. This is how you onboard a team member or a customer or a user of your system. Also look at things like runbooks, right? That helps you look at specific scenarios around troubleshooting and things like that. Another important aspect about documentation is like, not everything is automated and you actually don't need to automate everything right away, right? But you hit that second or third time you're trying to do the same thing. Maybe document at first if things are not automated, and then use that runbook or what have you to actually automate things later, right? Because that way there is a progression into getting to that automated state.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like everything doesn't have to be automated, because some things, like in my experience, one of the common scenarios I've hit over and over again, I work a lot with early stage startups. And so we'll build stuff and then that will fail and it just gets scrapped and never comes back to life. And so when I think about automating things, you know, I try to automate the things that are going to survive into the future. And it seems to save a lot of time. And I know that's, there's a tendency to automate everything, but for some things that just are going to fail fast and then disappear and never be brought back to life again, you can actually move a lot faster if you don't try to automate those.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, exactly. Like, especially, let's say you have a, there is an error in one of your environments, and then it's like fixing or troubleshooting, right? Even documenting those steps, and then eventually using that documentation to actually have a fix, right? Because
So whenever you talk about environments as code, is there a right size of team or environment where it starts to make sense to implement this?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's like if you have a very simple setup, yeah, it doesn't make sense to start complicating things, because obviously with this, like there also comes a little bit of complication. So yeah, I mean, I think I don't have a number for that, but I would say it's like a typical setup where you have various layers of your environments, right? So your networking layer, your platform layer, your application infrastructure layer, right? Like databases and things like that. Once you get into those kind of things and an application is not, like your setup is not as straightforward as, let's say, I'm just provisioning an EC2 instance or like just, you know, using Lambdas or what have you, right? Which is like very straightforward. Yeah, I would start thinking about it, because the other way to look at it as well is that, hey, let's start with writing these pipelines, right? That provision these to start with. And then once you start feeling that pain of like adding the third component or the fourth, and I was like, okay, now this is getting like, how do we tear it down? Then start looking with anything in software, right? Don't overcomplicate to start with. But once you start feeling that pain, think about a way to abstract it, which makes sense for provisioning the entire environment.
I think we can come up with a new buzzword there. Instead of test-driven development, we can call it pain-driven development.
I love it. Yeah, that's awesome.
It seems to be my big motivator.
Yeah.
So you've got some thoughts here on testing. What's your high-level overview of the types of testing that you need to have wrapped around this?
Yeah, so testing for infrastructure's code, environment code, thinking about the test pyramid that we keep talking about when we talk about application testing, right? So kind of similar idea, but obviously it's different, right? Like writing unit tests for your infrastructure's code is going to be complex. I mean, there are tools that allow you to. Whether you need it is another question, right? So let's kind of, Yeah. So let's kind of talk about a typical test pyramid for something like this. I start with at the bottom, it's like do static analysis, right? So if you're doing Terraform, like do things like Terraform Validate, EFLint, or maybe you're using Puppet or what have you, like all of these tools have some static analysis tool. Mm-hmm. When you get into unit testing, it really depends. What I tend to suggest is like, if it's something like Terraform that is declarative, that actually allows you to define the desired state, and it's Terraform's responsibility to actually get you to that desired state, versus more like your conditionals and things like that, where you need to write some complex unit tests and things like that. I would say you don't need unit tests when you're talking about declarative stuff, because you are not writing that logic to actually make something happen. You're just defining a desired state there. Right. And then it's the tool's job, right? So if there is a failure within the tool itself, it'll tell you that, hey, it can't get you to that desired state. So like most of the cases, you don't have those complex logic, right? But then if you move up this pyramid, you talk about integration tests, right? Which makes sense in this case, could be like in your provisioning pipeline or whatever you're using, you can bring up an ephemeral environment, a temporary environment, and then run some tests against that. So let's say you need a setup with networking and like some platform stuff like EKS and what have you. You can run some basic integration tests to see like if those resources have the things, like, for example, running to make sure like, hey, none of your S3 buckets are public, for example. So you do those things ahead of time rather than when you actually provision that production environment, right? So you don't want to be finding those issues late.
Right.
And then the last one there is like, which I've found useful, is like the best to test your infrastructure or environment that you have provisioned is by deploying a dummy app. So let's say you're provisioning a Kubernetes cluster, you can run like one simple dummy app that is close to what you would be typically running, and then run some smoke tests just to see like, you know, if you can get there. So again, it's a test pyramid. So at the bottom where your static analysis and things like that, you'll have more of those tests rather than, and when you, as you go up the pyramid, you have less of these tests because they are more expensive and time consuming.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things you said in there that I really want to call attention to is talking about unit tests, and with a declarative type framework like Terraform, there's really not a lot of value in unit tests, because at that point you're testing like, did the tool actually do its job? And a tool like Terraform already has tests to cover that. So you can save yourself a lot of time and effort by just acknowledging what tests the tool has that test that the tool is doing its job.
Right. But yeah, I mean, if you're writing, let's say, Bash, maybe, like where you have all this logic, then in that case, that's different. Yeah.
So how do you deal with baking security into the environment?
Yeah. And that's the thing a lot of people, like, I mean, that's a very important aspect, right? And a lot of people tend to like, hey, what, do we need to care about security here? But yeah, I mean, I think a few different things to consider. One is you, with these tools, right? Since it's automated, you need to give these languages, tools, or whatever is running access to your AWS, Azure, or whatever you're using to actually provision these, right? So the easiest thing is give root access, everything can do everything. And then, you know, if it's compromised, right? So I think one of the things is using a role-based access control or trying to limit the surface area of attack, right? And looking at if there are various layers of your infrastructure environment, maybe having different roles for those that give limited access to doing those things. Because especially when you're production running, one credential gets compromised or so, like you can compromise, basically give, and I've had those issues. I've gone through it with multiple customers. So that'll just stop everything, right? Like the whole thing is compromised rather than saying like, hey, there's limited access. So even if things are compromised, the surface area is less. Another thing you can do is if you use tools like HashiCorp Vault or I think even Secrets Manager, AWS, they have a rotation policy, right? So so you can have these dynamic credentials created that are then used. So again, it's time-based. They expire, right? So like you're not exposing it for a long time. But in general, you need secrets, right? So when you are provisioning your environments or infrastructure. So keep it in general, like just basics, right? Keep it in some kind of a good secrets management tool, which stores that. And then also looking at things like security scanning. So basically running those as part of your provisioning process early on, where you can spin up ephemeral environments. There are tools like CIS Benchmark, the Amazon has, AWS has Inspector, and things like that, that allows you to run these security tests or scanning to see like if you have things exposed, right? Like is your S3 bucket public somehow, or like your databases are exposed and things like that. So it'll also check for other vulnerabilities. So yeah, like, I mean, these are some of the things, writing some common security tests, like using InSpec and things like that also help, like where it could be like just any infrastructure environment you provision, we just run these kind of common security tests to see like your network is secured, your resources are secured, would also be a good idea.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the possibly hidden benefits to using this approach that you've got of the environment-based approach. Because like if you have this monolith infrastructure and you have security groups in there, you've got to think about this security group and say, oh, okay, this security group, they need access to MySQL and Elasticsearch and the Redis cache, and then there's an API server, and there's all these different rules and exceptions and all that kind of stuff in there that creates this huge vulnerability footprint. But if you break it down like you're recommending here, to where everything is just a component, then you can, when you're building out that component, you can say, well, this component needs to talk to Postgres. So we'll open the Postgres port, and you don't have to open anything else up. And then when you tear it down, you know that you can safely tear down that security group because you know the one and only place that it was ever used.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that I talk about when I talk about environment as code is like blueprints or templates for your entire environment, right? So if you build these blueprints using best practices, keeping security, compliance, and other best practices in mind, essentially you can templatize it and then kind of use that and say like, hey, we did this and this is like certified or, you know, by our team. And then you can share it with other teams within your org. So that gives you that, versus if you look at like, you know, doing it using pipeline or other things, it's very difficult to like, you know, create these templates for the entire environment.
Yeah, because once you change the pipeline, just everything downstream is now in an unknown state.
Yeah, plus these pipelines are not meant to run these things. They are more generic, and then like you write all the logic to make whatever happen, right? So it just gets complicated. Yeah.
So speaking of the pipeline, whenever you do the infrastructure and build this out, what are the pros and cons of using a tool like Jenkins or CircleCI to deploy this out versus writing it and building it and deploying it manually?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very important aspect, especially when, again, one thing I say, like if you have a very simple setup, you're getting started, maybe you don't need it right away because let's say you are the only developer, or like, you know, you have a very small team. But as you grow and you look at provisioning and automating these things, having this shared like execution environment, right? I call it, where things are set up which are replicated, right? So, hey, it works on my machine problem, right? Like, right. Like, hey, I ran this, but oh, you had this version of Terraform or this version of that, right? So you can avoid that. And basically, I feel like using any of these pipelines is one way, right? Or that have this a common setup that you use every time, right? So it's not your machine, it's something that's has all the tools and right versions and things like that. That definitely gives that. It also gives visibility, especially especially if you're running these tools, a lot of times, you know, they manage state. And if you run a lot of times things locally, you have local state and stuff like that. Moving all that to a shared place helps, because then, you know, if I'm doing something versus one of my team members is running, they all go to the same place to do that. Also, there's another way is GitOps, which is more and more talked about recently. But essentially how I see GitOps is basically you take your infrastructure as code, add a workflow to it, which is typically your PR process, which all the developers are used to. Is like, hey, create a PR, someone approves it. Once it's approved and merged to your main branch, it automatically provisions that. So now you don't need to push a button or do anything, right? But it also has this flow, which I feel is a nice flow of, like, you know, PR process, right? So you can have people approve it, take a look, comment it before you merge it. And then I also feel in there that GitOps is like this control loop logic, right? That talks about this detecting drift and kind of bringing back the desired state, actual state to desired state if things go out of sync. So I feel like that GitOps way is another way of looking at it when you are running your infrastructure's code or environment code, but using like this shared environment.
Hey folks, it's Charles Maxwood, and I just wanted to jump in here and let you know about something that I'm doing. It's free. It's out there just to help you get answers to your questions about the things that you're running into with your career. So if you have questions about how to get further ahead in your career, how to start a podcast, how to get a better job, how to get a raise, how to deal with a situation at work with your boss, or just maybe you're stuck and you don't know where to go next. You know, how do I get from junior to senior, senior to whatever's next? How do I become a speaker? How do I get to the next level? That's what I'm out here to do. So every Wednesday at 12 o'clock Mountain Time, I'm going to be doing a call, and it's going to be free, totally free. Go to devchat.tv/levelup and you can register for the call. It's using Zoom's webinar software, so it's pretty straightforward. And what we're going to be doing is I'll do 10 minutes and I'll just show you how I do some form of how I level up. And then we'll just answer questions. And it's not going to be a question and answer like, hey, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And then I say Rocky Road or whatever, right? Instead, what we're looking for is more along the lines of, yeah, I have this situation. How do I handle it? I'm trying to figure this thing out. How do I figure it out? I'm trying to stay current. How do I stay current? And if you have any of those kinds of questions, I'll bring you on the call. We'll ask some deeper questions. We'll make sure we get you a solid answer. And I'm really looking forward to helping some people out. There will be no sales, no selling, no nothing on these calls. It is literally just 10 minutes of training and then Q&A. So you can go check it out at devchat.tv/levelup.
Yeah, I think the shared environment is really, really key. Once you start adding multiple people and adding complexity to it, just to avoid, you know, avoid a lot of the issues that you mentioned where you have, you know, a different version of Terraform that has a breaking change in it, or whenever you have a new engineer come on trying to get their local workstation set up with all the different dependencies and having everyone to try to figure out the synchronizing of the state data and things like that. It's one of those, it becomes a headache really, really quickly if you don't have a centralized location to manage this from.
Yeah. And it also provides visibility, right? So like you can go to this place and kind of see the logs and, like, you know, if what failed and what not. Yeah.
Yeah. Even like at a really, really fundamental level, just looking at the bash history of that box, it's helpful to see what may have recently changed. But I use that all the time just to look and see how things that we don't do very frequently are done. Like, I know it's this command, but I don't remember which arguments or flags or things like that. We just check the bash history and it's right there.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's one of the cool things that GitOps actually provides is you put all of that into a place that's familiar for developers, you know, or the software engineers on your team. And then it's using the same or very similar workflow that they use for their own building your own applications. And I think it's been easier for me using a GitOps style approach to bring engineers into the on-call rotation, you know, because if you're asking them to go on call, a lot of times they'll be hesitant and say, well, what if it's a networking issue or something? Like, okay, it might be a networking issue, but it also might be a bad deploy or could be something with the application itself. So here's how it gets built, managed, and deployed. And it's the exact same process that you use for the application code.
Yep, totally.
So you're building out the environment as code. What's the state of that project? Is this something that you're going to roll out as a product offering?
Yeah, so we have actually MVP ready. It's called Z Lifecycle. It's a product that helps manage environment lifecycle. And basically, one of the concepts there is environment as code. So what we have done there is kind of have an easy way to define the entire environment. That then is used by the product to actually provision the whole environment. It provides a nice flow where you can approve various components. And then it has this drift detection and reconciliation, right? So it has a nice UI and then teardown. So it has visualization. So you can see the entire environment, how it's built and how it's connected. You can actually, we are also working on a builder that actually you can drag and drop and build the whole environment as a diagram, right? So it's basically rather than doing a Visio or like other tool, you drag and drop and build the whole environment. Under the hood, it's each component is just a Terraform or like any other IAC code, but it brings the whole thing. And as simple right now, it just generates a YAML. You can use that YAML, push it to Git, and it just picks up and gives you the whole environment.
Oh, that's super cool. And it works with AWS, Azure, Google, on-premises?
Yeah. So the MVP right now is AWS, but yeah, we support other providers as well. Essentially, like I said, under the hood, it is Terraform, or in future, we'll support other infrastructure as code tools, but basically anything that they can provision, which is going to be across the board.
Yeah, that opens up a lot of doors for you.
Definitely.
What's the right mix of integrating your infrastructure and DevOps style folks with the application engineers? How involved do you think application engineers need to be with the infrastructure that they're building for?
Oh, yeah, it depends. Like the classic consulting option. I mean, it's a tough question, but I think there are certain proven models, right? If you go to this like cross-functional team model where you say like, hey, one team has all your skill sets, including someone who actually is good at this infrastructure stuff, is just part of the team, right? So that's one model that, I mean, I recommend that all the time. But that requires certain level of maturity, right? So it's like, it's just product focused team with cross-functional folks. I mean, people talk about full stack developers and stuff like that, right? But yeah, in reality, a lot of times it just, you need maturity to get there.
Oh yeah.
But there are other models like platform engineering model that I highly recommend, where I actually have an article and I do talks on that as well, is around the central team that builds and automates and gives you all the right tools, right? So they give you this self-service platform to app dev teams. And a lot of times these teams are internal teams, right? So it shouldn't be like a wall where they, you know, be like, hey, we need a feature, create this. And then, you know, in 3 months you get this. There's a way more collaboration, right? So what I have recommended a lot of companies is like, hey, you can do like cross-team internships, right? Someone from a different app dev team actually comes, joins your team for a sprint, sits with you, understands the underpinnings of the platform, and then takes that knowledge back to these teams, right? And be this kind of hey, there's an issue next time. And okay, I'm the expert who actually knows within this team around that. So there's more collaboration. So I wouldn't call it like, hey, throw it over the wall mentality that back in the days, people like, hey, I'm done with my application. Now it's your job to deploy and like, you know, run it.
Right.
I mainly call it a team that enables self-service deployment and running of these applications in production.
Yeah. So then like your platform team is actually a team that gets distributed and embedded in the other teams, but then comes back to work with everyone else in their team for cross knowledge sharing, right?
Yeah, or the other way around. Like, I mean, it can't be like a central team that's a platform engineering team that builds this platform as a product, right? So they treat it as a product that's in most cases an internal product. But then one of the practices is basically saying like, hey, let's do this, call it cross team internship, where we invite various team members from other teams to come join, right?
And
say like, hey, let's learn about the platform. So it's not just like, hey, I need this. And it's just like, hey, like an app dev team will be like, hey, we need this feature. And then they just create this ticket and then they just get it in 3 months. But maybe like, hey, let's just actually pair on this, work on it together, because you are running your application, business critical stuff, let's say, on our platform. So understanding how to troubleshoot how things work under the hood is going to be helpful. I mean, it can be both vice versa, right, as well, right? Like, so someone from platform team is actually going, working with these app dev teams and kind of understanding how those apps work.
Right on. Cool. Is there anything else we should cover on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think again, coming back to like this thing around people, process, technology, which I'm really passionate about, you know, like technology is just means to an end, even though I'm an engineer at heart, like thinking about people and process and how things come together. And that's where like your last question around like people should talk to each other, like, you know, how you structure your teams. I think I always say like anything around this, like around technology, like a lot of problems are around people and process. So, which is a huge thing for me. Like it's I'm building a product, like where my company is like has a product around DevOps and cloud spaces for technologists, but that's, I always say it's enabling actually communication between various teams and making those things visible and with dashboards and other things to actually enable that, right? So, hey, I want to talk to like finance team around costs, right? How much does an environment cost, right? So people are used to like, you know, using various ways, but there's no visibility. Like same thing around a security InfoSec team, right? So they are like, okay, we provide all the data. InfoSec team is still kind of setting the rules maybe, but these kind of tools should, or products should enable that collaboration rather than like, hey, you just use this tool and everything's solved. It's not going to solve all the problems for you.
I got you. So the goal of the tool is to sort of stage the information so that you know who to have a conversation with and what the conversation should be about.
Yeah, like a big part is dashboarding and reporting, right? So like, and again, it's in general, right? We are talking about this product, but in general, like it's about providing data, the right information to the right people without going into like, hey, a simple example is finding cost or finding which teams within my organization is actually doing, let's say, machine learning or which cloud providers are they using. It's just getting that data is painful. So how do you provide that data in a better way so that then there'll definitely be more collaboration? Let's say, hey, you all are doing this. This looks cool, and this looks like something we can use help, right? Like we can use a similar setup, and then you just talk to them and figure it out. So yeah, that's a big part of it.
Right on. That's super cool. How do you think? How does discoverability work in that? So if I'm curious about something or looking into something, what's the mechanism for discovering that this data exists and that there is a potential conversation to have around it.
Yeah, that's a tough problem to solve, and it involves a lot of different things, right? So first of all, for data to make sense, there needs to be work done, right? Like, hey, I have all this data. Like, I know now that these are environments. So, I mean, strategies like tagging things appropriately needs work, right? You can have smart tagging or use some smarter ways. But at the end of the day, a lot of it also depends on what kind of information the team that's working on makes available, right? Like, or enables that. But yeah, a lot of it also is providing access. I mean, a lot of companies have like, hey, all my code is in this some other source control repository, like some other source, like, hey, someone's using Git versus like, you know, some other tool. And hey, we have all this code hidden.
Right.
No one has access, right? So a lot of it is also actually giving access and providing that data available at a central place, maybe. Why not enable, like, anyone can create a PR against something that's common and being used. And then the owners, this is kind of following this open source model, but within your company, right, where you can actually. A lot of it is that, but also like discoverability, more like, hey, providing it a common place, but there's a lot of work needed to actually make it discoverable, right? So using smart ways to tag things or name things. I mean, as simple as that.
Naming things is hard. Especially if you
with it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like naming a variable. It's like, oh God, I have to like really think hard. But it's important. Like sometimes even like using a long name, I was like, yeah, sure, it's long, but it kind of helps understand what it is.
There's just so much pressure around that. One benefit is now a lot of the tools just have really, really great autocomplete and IntelliSense. So you don't have that big feeling of guilt by using long variable names when it makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, other thing that has worked for me is creating this, what you call like a common vocabulary of things, right? Like, so I'm trying to look for the name. But yeah, like a central place where you would look for these things, right? So like going back to naming is important, but also like what terminology do you use within your org, right? To talk about these things. So like getting on the same page there, right? Because I've been at places where it's like, hey, when you say platform, it's like 10 different things, like depending on the context. So like making sure that you're all talking about the same thing, right? It is very important when you say a certain term. So yeah, like I think creating this common like place where you put these terms, agree on as a team or as a company, right? Where just helps.
Yeah. So that everyone knows whenever I say this word or this phrase, this is what I'm referring to.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just saves a lot of time, confusion, you know, like just all those things.
Yeah. Saves a lot of wasted effort from going off and working on the wrong thing because of a miscommunication.
Exactly. Yeah.
So on the topic of people, process, and technology, a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about in the last few minutes is very process oriented. And it sounds like that's almost the first step is to define what the process is. And so what's your recommendation for starting the process of building a process?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it, I mean, obviously agreeing as a team, but also being flexible, right? Being agile. I truly feel like everyone says we are agile, right? Like no one you ask would say like, hey, we are not.
Right.
But what I have seen is like a few different things. First of all, coming to some agreement that is good enough to get started, right? Like it doesn't have to be perfect, because a lot of times people are like, hey, no, everything needs to be perfect. Spend too much time trying to actually come up with that, right? You have to try it. You have to go through that. So once you decide on what works for the team, a simple process, try to keep it easy to get started and lean, right? Not overcomplicated, because then people just give up, right? It's like, hey, this is just too much. So starting small somewhere test out, and then be open to adapt, right? If things don't work, change. And again, this is also a lot of it's like how do the various folks within your team or within your organization are open to listening, right, to each other. Because, yeah, a lot of it is that, like, hey, doesn't have to be this hard written in stone process that everyone needs to follow, because people are different, they're building different things, they're used to different kind of processes. And what's the culture for your team, for your company, right? And how do you, so yeah, I mean, I would say some of those things, starting small, but keep being open to adapting to changes and doing retrospectives and understanding like what worked and what didn't work.
Yeah, you mentioned culture in there. And I was just as you were saying that, I was thinking about the different, you know, how likely you are to be successful with that approach in different types of organizations, you know, because if you're dealing with an older, larger corporate style environment that's used to having change review boards and steering committees and planning organizations, you know, it's easy to fall into that trap of, oh, we have to go down this 12-step process to agree that we're going to talk about doing this thing. That's like an immediate showstopper right there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you have as well. But being a consultant and having worked with various companies from startups to enterprise, like, yeah, I have seen like, you know, both the spectrums, right? And that's what I look for and try to learn and from these organizations as talking to them. It's like, yeah, I mean, some places are really, really difficult to even do a simple thing, right? And there is also like having empathy, right? Like, I mean, they are where they are because of a reason, right? Because not actually, because I've seen a lot of people are like consulting, like, hey, go, like, why are we doing this? Let's change everything. But actually understanding the history and having empathy for the people who are working there, because, you know, I mean, no one wants to do the wrong thing, right? It's just they are put in a position or what have you, right? And they go through that. So like understanding that, I feel, is a very important part of it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think part of that is why consultants get a bad rap, is because many times we come in and we're eager to implement change and we're successful at it without realizing what we broke in the process of changing things.
Yeah. And I have seen so many places like things are implemented and then I or my team leaves and they go back to what they're doing. Because it's like, hey, this is so hard. Like, it's not like I just want to go back to that was more comfortable, even if it wasn't the right thing to do. So, I mean, the real change is difficult and slow, right? It's not like, hey, let's just start using this tool or start writing unit tests and everything will be fine. It's just a way more than that.
Yeah, which really comes full circle all the way back to communication. You have to have those conversations to understand what the big picture is, and then use that to start building out a process and iterate on the process.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Easy to just throw it out in the podcast and say, yeah, there you go. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, that's true.
Right on, man. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah, I mean, super fun. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the invite. And I mean, it's just, I thought we were going to talk just infrastructure as code or environment as code. But yeah, I mean, I love that we talked about a lot of other things.
Yeah, I think that's important to do, because it's all related. You know, like the conversation we just had, it was infrastructure as code, but we talked about like the types of people that are involved in the conversations and the processes and the challenges, you know, and you just can't address any one single facet of it if you're going to be successful at implementing long-term change.
Yeah, definitely.
So if people want to contact you and get more info or keep in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is my last name, my first name. It's SHAHADARSH. That's the best way. I mean, my email as well. I have it up on my website, my personal, as well as you can contact via the company site as well. So yeah, I mean, in this day and age, if you just Google, people find them. So yeah.
And for anyone who doesn't want to Google, we'll have them included in the show notes down below as well. Cool. So the last thing on our list today is we always end the episode with picks, something to recommend for someone. If you got anything to share with us?
As in, like, what kind of picks? Sorry.
As in anything that you want to recommend that someone might find useful. I'll actually throw mine out first and then we'll see what comes up.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
My pick for the week is going to be a book from William B. Irvine called A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. I've owned this book for a while, but actually hadn't read it, and I dug it off the bookshelf not too long ago. And it's actually kind of cool. I like reading a lot of the Stoic stuff. The way that this one is formatted makes it really easy to just keep on my desk. And then when I have a few minutes, pop it open. And then each chapter in there addresses a specific topic or a specific subject. And then it's a quick read. So if you're interested in Stoic philosophy, or it kind of falls into that self-improvement category as well, but also meditation and mental health, It's a really good book, and it's easy. The thing I like most about it is it's easy to pick up, consume for a few minutes, and then set down and move on with your day. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, what I would say is what I've been fascinated for a long time and kind of learning is, and a lot of stuff in software actually came from Toyota. So there are a few books around Toyota. Like, again, I can provide you those. We can include in the link. But basically how Toyota work, a lot of things that we do, like Kanban and and then kind of also there's something called Toyota Kata. It's something that Mike Rother is the person who talks about it, is how to actually use those learnings to actually do anything, honestly, but build a product, how to get from stage A to stage B, or like whatever your end goal is. So I've been reading these books for a long time, but also like there's a lot of history to it, right? Like as in, hey, why do we do Kanban, or like why do we do X, Y in software? A lot of it would be from back in the day where like how Toyota used to be in trouble and like all these problems and how they evolved versus a lot of other car manufacturers, how they did it. So like learning from different industries, and car being one, just because. But yeah, I mean, like Toyota Kata is a book, I think. Yeah, I'm forgetting the exact name, but yeah, like if you look at Toyota books, it's definitely fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's such a great point, you know, because a lot of the way that we build software today was driven by the Toyota method of building cars. And it's cool to look at their history because they had such a horrible reputation in the automotive industry before doing that. And so like to look at what their track record was and how they changed as a company and to where they are today, and then to take those lessons and see how they translate one-to-one in the way that we build software is actually a really cool story.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, cool. Well, we'll have all of those links for you in the show notes down below. Thanks for listening. Adarsh, thanks for joining me. This has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Will. It was awesome.
Right on. Anytime, and we'll see y'all later.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.